and fallen into someone else's life. Someone with loving parents, family holidays, and poker games. Someone who knew what it was like to feel happy. And sometimes, when your world has been filled with fear and anguish, that feeling, even if fleeting, is all you need to carry on. Fern. Mercifully, Rose doesn't say much on the way home. I don't either. Even if I wanted to, I couldn't have, because that incredible sense of fatigue that always follows a sensory meltdown overcomes me. I feel like my eyelids have weights on them. I let them close and lean my head against the cool window. I'm starting to drift off when the car comes to a stop. "We're home," Rose says softly. I open my eyes. "No, we're not." "Okay," she says. "We're at my home." "I'm exhausted, Rose," I say, although it must be no later than 8 o'clock. "I want to go home." Rose opens her door. "You can sleep here tonight." "No, thanks." "Fern," she snaps. "After everything that has gone on tonight, please do me a favor and don't argue." I cross my arms. I don't like sleeping at other people's houses as a rule, not even Rose's. I never sleep well. Admittedly, I don't exactly sleep well anywhere, and it's worse than usual lately as I have to get up multiple times a night to pee. But tonight, especially after everything that's happened, I just want my own bed. "Fern, I don't have time for this. I had back-to-back meetings today and was only just on my way home when I get the call that you've had a spectacular meltdown and I have to come and rescue you." "Don't get me wrong, I'm happy to do it, but I'm tired and the least you can do is come inside." She gets out of the car. "If you're too tired to drive me," I say, also getting out, "I'll walk home." "Fern Elizabeth Castle!" Her tone is sharp, like a schoolteacher's. "You're staying here and that's final." "It's not final. I'm an adult, Rose. I can choose where I sleep." Rose raises her eyebrows. "If you're an adult, why do I need to be your round-the-clock carer?" Rose and I face off for several moments. That's when I notice what she is wearing. "If you were on your way home from work, why are you wearing leggings?" "Really, Fern?" Rose stares at me. "After I've driven across town to rescue you, you want to talk about what I'm wearing?" I want to tell her that yes, I do want to talk about that. But I can't, because Rose turns and stalks into the house before I have the chance. I remain where I am for several moments, huffing and sighing, before finally following her into the house. As suspected, I sleep badly. Among other things, the sheets on Rose's spare bed are some sort of polyester blend that makes my skin crawl. I make a note to talk to her about it tomorrow. But the sheets aren't the main reason for my insomnia. The main reason is that I can't stop replaying last night, reliving the horror over and over again. Me crawling under the table, covering my head with my hands, cowering like a child, having to be rescued by my sister while on a date. It's little wonder Rose treats me like a child. That's exactly how I'm behaving. What on earth must Wally think? Around 6 o'clock a.m., I give up on sleep, pull on my rainbow dress and head to the living room. Rose is already up, sipping a cup of tea on the couch in her dressing gown. "You're awake early," she says. "I don't sleep well at other people's places," I say, stretching my neck. Even though I told her this last night, I feel it bears repeating. "That dress looks itchy," Rose says. "Polyester?" "Yes, like your sheets." "I can give you a t-shirt and shorts if you like." "No thanks," I say. Unlike the sheets, the dress is worth the itch. Rose sits forward on the couch and places her mug on the coffee table. "Tea?" I'm about to decline, but then I realize I won't get out of here without at least having a warm drink with Rose, so I ask for a coffee. I intend to drink it quickly so I can go home to do my yoga and get the rest of my day back on track. While Rose is making my coffee, I notice Alfie scratching at the door, so I walk over and let him inside. I am closing the back door when I notice the base of a structure in the far corner of the garden. It looks like a cubby house in the process of construction. "What's that?" Rose walks out of the kitchen carrying a pink mug. What's what? Oh. She gets a sheepish look about her. Actually, I want to talk to you about that. She hands me my coffee and points at the couch. Sit. I remain standing. What is it? Rose sits and crosses her legs. I know you don't like staying at other people's houses, Fern. I know how important your routine is. And that's why I was thinking, well, what if this was your place? I put my coffee down. I don't understand. Where are you going? She frowns. Nowhere. I will stay in the main house and you would move in there. She points outside at the structure. It's a granny flat. It could be your own little place at my place. You've already started building it? I was going to surprise you, but now you're here and... She gives a little shrug and a guilty smile. I look again at the structure. It looks like a children's playhouse, an oversized dollhouse, not a place for an adult to live. It will be bigger than it looks now, Rose says, reading my thoughts. Once it's finished, obviously. It will have a bathroom and a kitchenette. It will even have air conditioning. My flat already has air conditioning. But your place is blocks away. This way, you'd be right here. Rose smiles, but she sounds impatient, even a little annoyed. So I do my best to disguise my horror at the idea of moving into her backyard doll's house. Fern, don't you want to be here? After the baby's born, don't you want to be a part of his or her life? See him or her every single day? I think about this. Yes. Well, while you're pregnant, I want to see you every single day. You get that, right? I want to be here for you in case you need anything. Now she smiles cajolingly. Ice cream, perhaps? A foot rub? Rose stands, picks up my coffee from the coffee table and hands it to me. I don't have a problem living with Rose, per se. I've lived with Rose for over half of my life. It isn't even the fact that I am reluctant to upset my routine. I suspected my pregnancy was going to do its fair share of that anyway. It's the fact that, in saying yes to moving in, I'd be saying no to another life. A life where I'm not entirely dependent on Rose. A life that I've been enjoying recently. But I like my place, I say carefully. I like my independence. But it feels ridiculous just saying it aloud. I still have dinner with Rose 3 times a week. I still call her whenever there is the slightest drama in my life. How independent am I, really? Rose doesn't respond, so I guess she's wondering the same thing. I look down at my coffee. Is this about Rocco? Rose asks after a short time. No, I say. And yes. I know you like him, Fern. But there is no happy ending to this, you know that, right? Rose's voice is softer now. You saw how it went last night. Rocco is doing well right now, getting himself started in a new business, traveling. The last thing he needs is to get himself into a complicated relationship. Fern, you're going to be showing soon. What will you tell him then? She doesn't give me time to answer. I really think it's better for everyone if you end it with him sooner rather than later. I hate it, but I know she's right. Last night proved it. Wally and I can't have a normal relationship. We can't even go out for dinner without it turning into a disaster. She's also right that I'll be showing soon. How would I explain that to Wally? Yes, I'm pregnant, but don't worry, my sister is going to raise our baby. All right, I say. I'll move in. Rose nods but looks at me expectantly. And I'll break up with Wally. Rose nods again. She doesn't smile, but I can tell that she's happy with my decision. She leans in for a hug, but this time I'm too fast. I dodge her and head to the kitchen. I can move in and break up with Wally. But a hug on top of that is more than I can take. At least for today. Journal of Rose Ingrid Castle. After the first night, Billy always came to our tent after Mum and Daniel went to bed. Every night as we played cards, we chatted in cycles about nothing of significance. Jokes and stories, comparing notes about teachers, asking each other questions about school or sport or favourite foods. Mum knew what we were up to, we weren't that quiet. But she and Daniel seemed happy enough to turn a blind eye. I wasn't stupid enough to think this would last. I knew she would be storing it up, along with a list of grievances that she would use against us when we got home. But like her, I was having so much fun, I found it difficult to care. On the second night, I took a sip of beer when Billy offered. On the third night, I had a few sips. Mum and Daniel never seemed to notice that there was beer missing, and I loved the way it made me feel close to Billy. We played a different card game each night. Billy's aim was to find a card game that Fern wasn't good at. Spoiler, he never found one. Every time Fern won, Billy complained and rolled his eyes, while I shushed him through giggles. "Give us a chance, would you?" he'd say, smiling. I had to admit, I was enjoying being the one who was less proficient with games, purely because it meant I got more of Billy's attention. Sitting by his side, sharing his can of beer and listening to him whisper the rules to the games in my ear, it felt like something I could do forever. I guess it was around this time I realized I had feelings for Billy. I couldn't help it. I felt it each time his knee brushed against mine. I may have been imagining it, but sometimes it felt like he pressed his thigh against mine on purpose. The idea that he was seeking me out, actively wanting me, it was intoxicating. I wanted to be around Billy as much as I could. I became his shadow, from the moment he woke up until the moment he went to bed. Where Billy was, I was too. "Like a puppy dog," Mum said under her breath one day. "Don't go making a fool of yourself, Rosie Round." She said it out of earshot of anyone else. Classic Mum. But the comment ate away at me. If Mum had noticed my feelings for Billy, did that mean Billy had noticed too? I made my mind up to keep my distance. So later that day, when Billy suggested we all go down to the river for a swim, I offered to stay back and help Daniel repair a hole in the tent. "Oh, come on," Billy said, looking genuinely disappointed. "It will be more fun if we all go." I managed to shake my head. "I'll meet you there later, okay?" He didn't protest again, but he looked sad as he and Fern trudged off. When I snuck a look at Mum, she looked victorious. Once again, I realized, I'd let her manipulate me. I repaired that hole just about as quickly as I could. When it was done, I all but ran down to the river. Mum and Daniel came too, walking just a short distance behind me. I reached the river a minute or so before them and noticed Billy and Fern were nowhere to be seen. I scanned the trees, the water, the rope swing. Downstream, a couple of inflatable boats held half a dozen people who were shouting to one another and laughing, but no Fern or Billy. "That's odd," Daniel said when he and Mum joined me. "They said they were coming here, didn't they?" "I'm sure they're about somewhere," Mum said, even though there weren't a lot of other places to go down there. Daniel had just suggested I run back to camp when we were startled by the disturbance of water, followed by a sharp, deep intake of air. "Billy," Daniel exclaimed, "there you are." Billy stood waist deep in the water, gasping for breath. He didn't appear to be harmed. He was grinning. His torso, which was long and pleasantly defined, shimmered with water. "Where were you?" Daniel exclaimed. "Where is Fern?" I said. Billy's grin slipped. "She's not here?" I felt a flutter of panic. There were lots of reeds in this part of the water. What if Fern had got tangled in them? What if she was stuck? I was about to launch myself into the water to look for her, when there was another splash, another gasp for air. And then Fern was there, wet from head to toe. Unlike Billy, she was barely panting. Billy groaned. No way. We were seeing who could hold their breath the longest, Fern explained. I won, again. She must have an oxygen tank under there, Billy muttered. I read a book about free diving, Fern explained. Billy rolled his eyes. It's called lung packing, Billy, Fern said. It's a very simple technique. Billy shoved her playfully, and Fern frowned. I knew she would see this kind of gesture as confusing after she had provided him with such useful information. After a moment, she shoved him back. Fern had been doing karate for a few years by then, and was stronger than she looked. Billy fell backward into the water.
Feisty, he said,
laughing as he got back on his feet.
Best out of three?
Fern looked confused, but she nodded, and they both inhaled deeply and then dived under the water again. As they disappeared, I noticed Mum was watching the interaction closely.
I think someone's got a crush, she said to Daniel, waggling her eyebrows.
Who?
Daniel said, oblivious. He was bent over, digging through stones, most likely looking for a smooth one for skimming, but hearing Mum's comment, he stood.
Billy? On Fern?
Mum's smile grew. I think it might be mutual. Daniel frowned.
Do you want me to talk to him?
No, Mum said, waving her hand. You'll only embarrass him. Besides, it's a little crush, it's not hurting anyone. Daniel shrugged and after a moment went back to looking for stones. Once she was sure he was distracted, Mum looked me dead in the eye and smiled.
Fern. Wally knocks at my front door at 6:45 p.m., exactly 15 minutes earlier than the suggested time of 7 p.m. This little detail alone is enough to make me second-guess myself. It's been a week since I decided to end my relationship with Wally, but this has been the first time I've had the opportunity and inclination to do it. Wally always seems to be working late or traveling or in meetings. He hasn't been to the library once. Rose has used this as reinforcement that I am doing the right thing.
You see, he doesn't have time to even see you. When would he have time to raise a baby?
She has a point, as usual. Wally knocks again, and I open the door.
Hey, he says.
For the first time in ages, Wally isn't wearing a suit. He is wearing that lumberjack shirt he had on the first time I saw him at the library, with jeans and sneakers. He is even wearing his stripy hat. He gives me a smile that somehow makes me feel sad.
Hello.
The pitch of my voice is a little higher than usual. I'd had a flutter in my chest all day thinking about what I was going to do tonight, but suddenly the flutter is more of a flapping. I wrap my arms around myself and take a deep, slow breath.
Are you okay?
Wally asks, still in the doorway. Over the past week, as Wally and I have communicated via text message, he has asked me this many times. He has also asked me to forgive him. Each time I have informed him that there is no need to ask forgiveness. To the contrary, I am the one who should apologize. Still, Wally has obviously sensed something is up, perhaps due to the absence of exes in our text messages these past few days, a tip from Rose so as not to give him mixed messages.
I'm perfectly okay, I tell him. Please come in.
Upon entering, Wally turns quickly right and left. I'd forgotten the state of the flat would come as a surprise to him. The last time he was here, the place was, of course, furnished. But over the past few days, Rose and I have more or less cleared the place out, moving my belongings to Rose's, the spare room, until the doll's house is finished. Tomorrow, I will be returning the key to the landlord.
I've moved into Rose's house, I explain.
Oddly, this doesn't appear to be news to Wally, even though I hadn't mentioned anything about moving out of my flat. He looks at me sadly.
Are you breaking up with me?
The words catch me off guard. Breaking up? All of a sudden, it sounds like something teenagers do in the hallway at high school between classes. Not teenagers like me. I read books in the hallway at high school between classes. It also indicated that he had indeed noticed the lack of exes in our text messages.
I'd like to end our relationship, yes, I said.
Because of dinner last week?
No.
Then why?
I look at his too loose jeans, his black lace-up sneakers, and have a sudden recollection of thinking he was homeless. It's funny, remembering the time you didn't know someone once you do know them. The first time I had met Janet, I'd thought she was going to be brash and loud. She wore brightly coloured resin jewellery that I had always found went hand in hand with brash, loud people. I got that wrong. And I'd got Wally wrong too.
Is it because of your sister?
I tell him it's not, but his jaw tightens anyway.
Can I say something?
He says.
I know you love your sister, but...
He shakes his head, sighs.
Something isn't right about her. It's like she doesn't know where she ends and you begin. It's like she thinks you belong to her or something.
I frown.
And you don't have great boundaries with her either. You blindly believe things that she tells you. You don't question anything she says.
I think about that for a moment.
Was it Rose's idea that we break up?
He asks. I cross my arms. Wally raises his eyebrows.
Why isn't that a surprise?
He says.
Fern, if you can tell me one reason you want to break up, then I'll...
I've met someone else, I say. This silences Wally, as it was intended to. For now, I try not to think about the fact that it was Rose's idea to say this. You can't let him talk you out of it. As soon as he starts arguing with you, you need to say you've met someone else. He can't argue with that. It will make it clean and fast.
When?
A few weeks back. You haven't been around a lot lately. I avoid his gaze.
Wow. So, it's serious? You really like the guy?
It has to sting, Rose had said, but it's a kindness in disguise. Yes, I say. Wally's face looks heartbreakingly sad.
I'm sorry. I was caught up in the business. I didn't make you a priority.
It will be hard, Fern. You will want to let him talk you out of it, but you can't. When he gets upset, you need to say nothing at all.
This part at least is easy because I can't speak. All my thoughts and feelings have settled in my throat, forming a seal.
I wrap my arms around my middle. He takes a step toward me, but then at the last minute changes his mind.
Well, he says, I guess I'd better go then.
I nod. The seal in my throat tightens. He heads for the door. The flap in my chest becomes something else, something heavier, more like a heavy, sinking pain. When his hand is on the door, he turns back.
Can you do something for me?
He says. I nod.
Remember what I said about your sister.
He doesn't wait for me to respond, just turns and lets himself out. Living with Rose isn't so bad. She buys new sheets for my bed, 100% bamboo, and makes space in the living room for me to do my yoga. And in the evenings, we spend quiet time together watching movies or reading books on the couch. I have heard that pregnancy makes you tired, and as it turns out, it is no joke. Luckily, I find plenty of opportunities to nap, on my yoga mat, in the children's section of the library on the beanbag, in Gail's car when I go out to fetch a lemon. I sneak these little kips as often as I can. And when I do, I have dreams. Unusual dreams in vivid colour. Usually about Wally. I'm unprepared for the relentless way I miss Wally. All day, every day, I miss him. It is a gnawing pain in my chest, a pain that makes me want to crawl out of my skin. It reminds me of the way I missed Mum after her overdose, enough to make me howl. I'd learned somewhere along the way that you were supposed to miss people silently. Missing people aloud upset people. It made them feel like they weren't enough, that you didn't care about them. Rose, in particular, felt like this.
You only care about Mum. I'm the one who has looked after you all your damn life.
I don't want anyone to feel like I don't care about them. So I grieve silently, invisibly. It's worked for me so far in this life. But there's another loss coming my way very soon. My baby. And that one
I fear, might be the one that topples me. The morning sickness reaches its peak at around 8 weeks. I feel constantly nauseated, and the smell of food is often enough to make me weak. When borrowers approach me at the library, I don't even bother pretending someone is calling me. I simply keep my eyes forward and keep walking. One lunchtime, Trevor reheats some leftover Chinese food in the microwave, and the smell is so overpowering I have to remove the food, put it into a plastic bag, and take it immediately to the outside rubbish bin, ignoring his cries of protest. When Trevor tries to question me about it, I'm still feeling too sick to talk, so I merely hold up a palm and head for the secret cupboard. I become acutely aware of every change to my body. The tenderness of my breasts, the patterns of my hunger, the length of time between visits to the bathroom. It's a nonsensical puzzle for which there are few answers. In fact, the more I read about having babies, the more I realize that the process is primitive and dated. It is astonishing to me that with all the medical advancements of recent times, they haven't come up with a better way to do it. For goodness sake, not only does a woman have to house the fetus in her uterus for 9 months and then push it out of an inadequately sized orifice, or even worse, have it cut out of her if it won't come by itself, she is then expected to care for the baby on an hourly basis, feeding it fluids from her still healing body. Lunacy. There has to be a better way. But no matter how much I research it, I have yet to find an alternative. At 12 weeks, Rose and I go to the baby's first scan. Rose introduces herself to the sonographer as the mother, and I find myself with the title surrogate. I'm taken aback by the emotion I feel when I see movement on the black and white screen. I imagine the hormones are to blame. The sonographer shows us the baby's head, the baby's spine, the four chambers of the baby's heart. She even flicks a button so the picture becomes three-dimensional, turning the baby a reddish-pink color and giving it a look of ET. That's how I know it must be the hormones that are behind my feelings. No one but a mother could love something that strange-looking. But then again, I'm not the mother. I'm the surrogate. Is there a dad in the picture? The sonographer asks as we are finishing up. I can print out a photo for him, if so. Dad would love a photo, Rose says. He's out of town on business at the moment. According to Rose, Owen will be coming home as soon as he finishes up his work assignment. Last week, he even sent a little Paddington bear from London in the post, along with a printed card saying he'd also bought a Paddington book, which he couldn't wait to read to him or her. That had made me smile. Owen was going to be a great dad, and my baby, Rose's baby, would be lucky to have him. Still, as I watch the picture of the baby on the screen, as the surrogate, I feel an ache in my chest that makes me finally understand that feeling people call a broken heart. What are you up to over there? Rose asks me. She's in her jogging clothing on the way out the door, and I'm sitting at the kitchen table with my book and the library's What's On catalogue, which details upcoming events in the library. I also have my hospital admission paperwork. I was impressed by the promptness with which the hospital admissions paperwork arrived, following my 12-week ultrasound. It arrived the very next day. Apart from appreciating the efficiency of their system, I was pleased to find that it had come the old-fashioned way, 5 high-stock pages of A4 paper folded in 3. Most paperwork is emailed these days. A shame, I think, as I've always enjoyed filling out paperwork the traditional way with pen and paper. I like the precise little boxes, one for each letter. I enjoy the gentle scratch of my ballpoint pen against the page, the pop of blue against the black and white page. Fern, what are you doing? Lately, it feels like Rose has an insatiable interest in what I'm doing. It doesn't matter if she's rushing out to a meeting or in the middle of watching a gripping television program. Her interest in my goings-on is as relentless as it is complete. I sigh. I'm reading and doing some paperwork. She appears behind me, peering down at the page, which is terrifically irritating. I've completed most of it. The only boxes that remain empty are under the emergency contacts heading. Put me down as your emergency, she says immediately.
After a short pause, she adds, "Unless there's someone else you want to list." I might be imagining it, but I hear the faintest hint of a laugh in her voice. I wonder what is so funny. "There's no one else," I say, filling in four little boxes with the letters of her name. Because Rose, once again, is my person. Other people may come and go, but she will always be here. I know I'm lucky for that. It's just that today, it makes me feel sad. When I am 4 months pregnant, Rose says she wants to talk to me about something important. More and more, it feels like everything is important to Rose. What I eat, how much I sleep, not sleeping flat on my back. But today, her expression is more somber than usual. It piques my interest. We sit at the kitchen table and she sets a stack of documents on the table before me. "What is this?" I ask. "This is an adoption order, which legally transfers all parental rights and responsibilities from you to me." I frown at the documentation, pages long and full of legalese. The words "relinquish parental rights" jump out at me. "It's just a formality," Rose says. "We don't need to make anything official until after the baby is born. But I did want to talk to you about Rocco." I look at her. "What about him?" Rose frowns and chews her bottom lip gently. "I've been doing some reading about the adoption process, and when the baby is born, I think it would be better if you didn't name him on the birth certificate."
"Why?"
"Well," Rose says carefully, "if you do name him, he will be required to consent to the adoption, which will be a little bit awkward as he doesn't know the baby exists." She makes a good point, one I hadn't thought of.
"So, who would I name as the father? Just make someone up?"
"Well, no, because then you'd be required to have him consent to the adoption."
"Oh."
"Therefore, I think it would be easiest to simply say you don't know who the father is."
I laugh. "I don't know? That's ridiculous. How could a person not know who the father of their baby is?"
Rose doesn't laugh. "It's not as ridiculous as you think. If you had more than one sexual partner at the time of conception, or if you had a one-night stand with someone you never saw again, it's possible that you wouldn't know who the father is."
I stop laughing. "And that's what you want me to say? That I had multiple sexual partners at once or a one-night stand with a stranger?"
"I know you wouldn't do that, Fern, of course you wouldn't. But it doesn't matter. It's just about doing what's right for the baby."
I stare at the table in front of me. I suspect she's right. Still, it bothers me. I understand that the baby will be better off with Rose and Owen. But erasing Wally from the document? It's almost like he never existed. Some days, that's how it feels, actually. Like he was a character in a book I read, rather than an actual person in my life. If it wasn't for the baby I was carrying, I'd suspect that was exactly what he was.
"Okay?" Rose asks.
And I nod, because my throat chooses that moment to swell up, and I can't reply. It gets hotter, and I become more pregnant. I'd always found the heat irritating, but pregnancy adds another suffocating layer. The library at least is air-conditioned, but each day the walk home becomes harder to enjoy. By the end of the 4th month, my elastic waist skirts are tight even around my hips, digging in and cutting me in half and driving me crazy. The moment I get home, I tear them off and wear one of Rose's loose 90s instead. Rose has also added another suffocating layer to my life. She's around constantly, and not just in the morning and evening. Some days she even pops into the library just to say hi, wanting to feel the baby kick. The timing of these visits is invariably poor, when I've just finished my break or when I'm about to head into a staff meeting. And perhaps it's the pregnancy, but I find myself getting annoyed with her. As she arrives today, third unannounced visit this week, I think of what Wally said to me. It's like she doesn't know where she ends and you begin. It's like she thinks you belong to her or something. "What are you doing here again, Rose?" I ask. She looks surprised and a little wounded by the question.
Visiting you, of course.
Don't you have to work? I ask.
I was in the area, Rose says, and I wonder what interior design business would have brought her to this area.
She takes my arm and leads me over to the couches in the children's area.
It reminds me of what Wally said about me. You don't have great boundaries with her either.
After Wally had said this, I'd taken the opportunity to Google great boundaries, and I'd come across an article entitled How to Set Healthy Boundaries, which suggested three helpful tips when saying no. Be polite but firm. Explain why but do not over-explain. Stay calm and on message. I decide it might be a good moment to employ these strategies.
Thank you for the visit, Rose, I say, which I think means the polite tip. But I need to work.
Firm, without over-explaining.
Rose frowns.
But I've come all the way to see you.
I thought you were in the area, I say. But in any case, perhaps calling ahead next time would be a good idea.
Rose blinks.
You want me to go?
Her face is blank now, but there is a challenge in her voice. Maybe even a dare. The hairs on the back of my neck stand up.
Yes, I say. I stand and turn away from her, but not before I see her jaw drop. As I walk into the staff room, I force myself not to look back. Setting boundaries isn't easy. I walk straight to my desk and Google great boundaries again. Seems like I'm going to need a little more help with this. When we were little, Rose was a pro at giving someone the silent treatment. It was, Mum and I used to say behind her back, her area of expertise. The slightest infraction could result in several days of steely silence. Now that we are adults, it's improved a lot, but she still occasionally does it. So when I get home from the library that night, I'm prepared for the worst. Instead, the minute I walk in the door, I receive a smile and a large flat cardboard box tied with a bow.
Sit down!
Rose's face is clear and shiny, and her eyes are bright.
I bought you a present.
She pushes me onto the couch and sits on the coffee table right in front of me.
I've been a bit preoccupied with the baby lately, and I think I might have been a bit pushy and overzealous at times.
She smiles.
Guilty as charged. So this,
she touches the box,
is my way of saying that I really do appreciate you.
I glance nervously at the box. Rose puts it into my lap.
Open it.
After I fumble trying to undo the bow, Rose takes over, untying it quickly and pulling out a dress. She stands and lets it unravel against her. It's a long dress striped with every color of the rainbow. It has elbow-length sleeves and an empire waistline with light flowy fabric that runs to the floor. I rub the fabric between my fingers. It's as soft as butter.
Do you love it? Rose says.
I open my mouth.
I know you loved the rainbow dress that Rocco bought you, Rose explains. And this is so similar. I bought it from Ripe Maternity, then took it to the alterations place to get French seams so they wouldn't irritate you.
Her smile becomes wider.
And it's 100% organic bamboo.
Before I know it, Rose is pulling my t-shirt over my head and instructing me to stand up and take my skirt off. I do as she says and then stand there in my bra and underwear. She puts the dress on me and makes me twirl. It's kind of bizarre, but I go along with it. Rose can be quite convincing when she's in this kind of mood. It's something I'd forgotten about her. She has a gift for knowing when she is at risk of getting on my nerves and managing to sneak back into my good graces at the 11th hour. Sisterly relationships are so strange in this way. The way I can be mad at Rose but still want to please her, be terrified of her and also want to run to her, hate her and love her, both at the same time. Maybe when it comes to sisters, boundaries are always a little bit blurry. Blurred boundaries, I think, are what sisters do best.
Journal of Rose Ingrid Castle. On the second to last night of our camping trip, Mum and Daniel went to bed right after dinner. Don't stay up too late, they said, as they disappeared into their tent.
It had been a long day of swimming, hiking, and collecting firewood, and everyone was a little worn out.
"Are we playing cards?" Billy asked the moment they were gone. He'd been getting bolder with the beer drinking, and that night he'd even had one under the camp table during dinner while Mum and Daniel were right there.
"I'm just going to rest my eyes for a minute," Fern said. She had been the most active of everyone that day, always diving the deepest, climbing the highest, collecting the most firewood. She looked absolutely exhausted.
"I don't think we can play cards without her," I said.
"You're right," Billy agreed. I assumed that was going to be the end of it, so I was surprised when Billy said, "We could go to the river to skim stones if you like."
I hesitated. We weren't supposed to leave the camp without telling Mum and Daniel. Daniel had been so adamant about it that Mum had joined in.
"Did you hear that, girls? No leaving the camp without telling one of us where you are."
But if Billy was worried about getting in trouble, he hid it well.
"Rose?"
Billy prompted. "Do you want to?"
Of course I wanted to. I wanted to only slightly more than I feared getting caught. And as it turned out, that was enough.
"Sure," I said. "Why not?"
It was pitch black as we followed the foot-worn path through the trees toward the river with only Billy's torch to light the way. We didn't talk for fear of being heard, and that was fine by me. Every stick and leaf we stepped on crackled unbelievably loud. My heart was in my throat the entire way to the river. I was so worried that Mum would wake and find us missing.
"You're shaking," Billy said, laughing. "What is the matter?"
"Remember what Mum and Daniel said about not leaving the camp?" I whispered.
"Ah," Billy waved his hand. "They don't care as long as we leave them alone." I thought about that. On this trip, at least, that did appear to be the case.
"I guess you're right."
He laughed again.
"Usually am."
We stopped in front of the river and started picking up stones.
"I'm glad we did this," Billy said.
"Me too."
"I think you're awesome, Rose."
I felt my cheeks turning crimson. I continued to collect stones.
"Thanks. I think you're pretty cool too."
I snuck a look at him. He was grinning. I found myself grinning too.
"Right," he said, standing. "Shall we skim?"
I nodded. Billy picked a stone and lined up the arc. He shifted on the rocks so his legs were hip distance apart and practiced the skimming motion. Then it was time for the real thing. One, two. But on three, instead of releasing the stone, he turned suddenly and kissed me full on the mouth. The air vanished from my lungs. It wasn't a kiss out of the movies. Our teeth knocked. He said, "Ow." We laughed. Billy pulled back.
"Smooth, right?"
"The teeth knocking especially," I agreed. "Did you practice that?"
"Only in my head." We smiled at each other. The next time he kissed me, our teeth didn't touch. It was slower. Better.
"Rose?"
Billy and I leaped apart, blinking into the darkness. It took me a moment to recognize the voice.
"What are you doing?" Fern said.
"Just skimming stones," Billy said, withholding a smile.
"Yeah," I said. "Billy is hopeless."
Fern looked at us. There was something about her expression. Fern always saw more than people thought. I had a feeling she knew exactly what we were doing. She didn't look happy about it.
"Let's go back to camp," I said.
Fern waited until Billy disappeared up the track and then fell into step beside me. I waited for her to inundate me with questions, but she didn't. She didn't say a word. Back at the camp, Fern went straight to bed without a word, and I lay awake, thinking about Billy. It wasn't until later that I thought about the way Fern had looked at Billy down at the lake. Like she was angry. Like she hated him. It actually looked like she wanted to kill him.
Fern. At 18 weeks, while setting up chairs for the Toastmasters group, I feel the baby move for the first time. It doesn't feel like much, barely anything at all, like someone is tapping me from the inside. A small, rather benign experience, and yet at the same time, the very definition of pleasure. It is, I suspect, what happiness feels like. After that, I am aware of the baby every second. I spend hours reading books and Googling. Is it cold when I am cold? Hot when I am hot? Does it hear my heart beating loudly from the inside? I pay attention to its movements to try to intuit its likes and dislikes. Judging from its movements, he or she is a little like me, because the one time I can guarantee movement is at night when it's quiet and I am lying in bed. I find myself looking forward to that time all day, when I pull up my nightie and watch the little elbows or feet or shoulders bumping around under my skin. I love that time, because Rose isn't around to see it. It's our time, just the baby and me. I've always enjoyed my job at the library, but as the months of my pregnancy pass, work becomes even more of an oasis. Carmel is part of it. Since our shadow day, she's given me a lot more freedom, but she's also asked for a few things in exchange. Greeting people as they enter the library with eye contact is one of them, so I've devised a system where I look at the patch of skin between people's eyebrows instead. Delightfully, everyone is none the wiser, and the results of this pseudo-eye contact are surprisingly good. Now people smile and wave to me as they enter the library. Some pause to tell me how much they enjoyed a book I recommended. Others compliment me on my fashion choice of the day. Once, I even became engaged in an impromptu discussion with a group of women who'd all read The Secret Life of Shirley Sullivan by Lisa Ireland. I'd suggested they start a proper book club at the library, and Carmel gave me permission to host it in the training room and order fruit and cheese. Not as good as cake, but not bad. All in all, with my new eye contact trick, I find the front desk is no longer the fearsome place it once was, and I have Carmel to thank. One day, as I am taking my place at the front desk, I become aware of Gail hovering nearby. Her eyes flicker here and there. She looks quite bizarre. "Is everything all right, Gail?" I ask her as I lower myself into the ergonomic chair at my desk. "Fine," she says. "It's just... may I ask you something?" I wince as my lower back hits the seat. "You may." "I just wondered if you had anything to tell us." She glances demonstrably at my burgeoning belly. "An announcement, perhaps?" I notice Linda a few meters away listening. When she sees me looking, she glances quickly at the bookshelves. I am perplexed by the question. I am 6 months pregnant now, and it is, quite frankly, obvious to anyone without vision impairment that I am pregnant. "If you're asking if I am pregnant, I can confirm that I am. Nearly 6 months along," I add. As people, including the nurses at Sunmeadows, the lady I'd passed at the bus stop yesterday, and the sales assistant at the pharmacy where I buy my prenatal vitamins, seem interested in these sorts of details. Gail and Linda gasp in unison.
6 months," Gail says. "My goodness, why didn't you tell us?"
I wonder if this was a social faux pas. Am I expected to tell every person that I work with that I am pregnant? I assumed they would notice my growing belly and consider themselves informed, but I am well aware of the offence it can cause if I fail to adhere to certain social graces. "Well, you don't like to announce these things too early," I say, as this does appear to be the case. "In case, heaven forbid, something goes wrong." Gail nods, apparently satisfied with this explanation.
"So, who is the father?" Linda asks.
"It isn't that handsome American, is it? From the bowling?" I busy myself by scanning my desk calendar. As I haven't been seen with any men other than Wally, it's natural that this is what people will assume, but I don't like to confirm it since I haven't told Wally himself. I'd hoped this would be one of those social situations where people felt it was impolite to ask.
As this clearly isn't the case, I ignore the question and start shuffling books around my desk instead. After a moment or two, Gale and Linda take the hint and scuttle away. The downside is that Carmel chooses this moment to approach.
"Just the woman I was looking for," she says. "Gail is giving a how-to class on IT troubleshooting this morning, which covers the printers and photocopiers. I thought you might like to join."
I open my mouth to protest, but Carmel gets in first.
"It's a two-hour class, and you can sit down the whole time."
We lock eyes. Carmel hasn't commented on my pregnancy yet, but it's obvious she knows. Last week, for example, when she caught me coming out of the secret cupboard after a two-hour nap, she simply looked the other way. And the week before last, she asked me to cover some new books in contact paper, which allowed me to sit down for nearly half my shift. Then there are all the other times she's brought me a glass of water or suggested I pop outside for some fresh air.
"It's pretty straightforward, and if you pick it up, you could even teach the class in the future," Carmel says. "It would mean you could sit down for a few hours each week while teaching, and there are free cakes and cups of tea."
It's the cakes that get me across the line. I still bring my sandwich to the library, but these last few weeks I've found myself ravenous between meals, and the idea of cake is simply too much to resist. I head to the training room 15 minutes early, naturally, and take a seat at the front of the class. As others arrive, I'm encouraged by the fact that they, all older than me by at least a good 30 years, share my distaste for IT troubleshooting. I also understand that, like me, they're in a bit of an if-you-can't-beat-them-join-them situation. As such, I feel a certain camaraderie with the old folks. Like me, they grumble into their seats, glancing suspiciously at the handbooks laid out at each station before giving Gale their reluctant attention. Like me, they are hopeful to learn, but even more hopeful that the whole process will be easy to discount as too complex, too difficult, beyond their abilities. So we are all disappointed to find Gail's voice soothing and simple, her teaching manner easy to digest. At the end of the 2 hours, I believe I could guide one of my classmates through a number of troubleshooting situations quite easily. Carmel is waiting for me as I exit the class, and I am forced to report that the class was more straightforward than expected. When pushed, I also tell her I might consider running the class after another session or two under Gail's guidance. From the coy smile on Carmel's face, she takes it as a win. That afternoon, when I go to see Mum, Teresa is there as usual with her machine. Mum has been getting better each time I see her. She strings two or three words together without a pause now.
"How are you? Aren't you cold? Can I have more water?"
She's not reading novels, as Teresa had suggested, but she's definitely making improvements. "Hello," I say from the doorway. Teresa looks up.
"Fern!"
Mum doesn't look like she's having a good day. Her hair isn't done. She's wearing pyjama pants and a t-shirt and has just socks on her feet. And her face is tear-stained.
"I think Nina's had enough for one day," Teresa says to me as I walk in.
"What's wrong, Mum?" Mum shakes her head and dabs at her cheek with a tissue. Teresa makes a motion with her head that I have learned means that I should move out into the hallway so we can have a little chat, which I do. When Teresa joins me, she lowers her voice.
"I need to warn you about something."
Teresa pauses as if expecting me to say something. She hasn't asked a question, but I give her a nod as a compromise.
"Your mother has been saying things these past few weeks," she says.
"Yes, I know."
"Yes, but she's been saying some strange things. And I don't want you to worry. Confabulation is common with patients with an acquired brain injury."
Confabulation is the spontaneous production of false memories which never occurred. Sometimes it's memories of actual events that are displaced in space or time." I am intrigued. "You mean she's making up stories?"
"In a sense, except she doesn't know it.
Confabulation isn't lying. Your mother believes she's telling the truth. With many patients, there is some truth mixed with fantasy. It's like her brain is playing tricks on her.
What is she saying?
Different things. She talks about your sister a lot. She says loving things and then other things.
What kind of things?
It's quite ridiculous. Sometimes she says she is trying to kill her.
But Rose hasn't seen Mum for more than 10 years.
Teresa laughs. It sounds stupid, but in the moment she believes it. The best thing is not to make a fuss and just try to keep her calm.
What else does she say?
Lately, she's been talking about a little boy called Billy.
I feel myself stiffen. What did she say about him?
She's brought it up a number of times. She says that Billy drowned, or apparently drowned, but it was actually murder.
She laughs sadly before I have the chance to react. I glance back through the door at Mum.
She was getting herself quite upset,
Teresa says needlessly. What should I do?
The best way to handle it, in my experience, is to act as though what she is saying is true and you are taking it seriously. Most likely she will then forget about it and move on.
Okay. Teresa smiles.
Don't worry, Fern. I know it sounds strange, but honestly, confabulation is very common. In a few minutes she'll have forgotten the lot.
I look back at Mum, still dabbing her eyes. But what if it's not confabulation, I wonder? What do we do then? That night, Rose and I make spaghetti bolognese. I wear the goggles Wally gave me while I chop the onion, and I don't cry a single tear. Rose rolls her eyes at me, but I don't care. I like wearing them. I saw Mum today, I say to Rose as I dice.
Hmm?
Rose pauses from grating a carrot and fiddles with her rose bracelet. Mum, she was talking in sentences, I say. Actual sentences. She's been having electromagnetic therapy. It's the new speech therapist she's been seeing. Rose stops fiddling with the bracelet and looks up.
What is she saying?
She can repeat things that Teresa says.
Who?
Her speech therapist. I feel a whisper of irritation. You would know if you'd visited her. Rose blinks. For a moment, I think she's going to argue with me, but instead she says,
So she's repeating things?
Yes, and she can ask for a drink, say she's hot, that kind of thing.
Oh.
Rose turns her back to me, slicing the top of a zucchini. Teresa also said she mentioned Billy, Rose, and murder. Rose keeps her back to me, but she becomes still.
I'm worried, Rose. What if someone suspects something?
Now Rose turns.
Well, what did Teresa say? Did she seem concerned?
I shrug. She says confabulation is common among patients with acquired brain injuries.
Confabulation?
Rose's bracelet falls off her wrist and clatters against the floor. She swears under her breath. She thinks Mum's brain created a story. She says it's common for people with acquired brain injuries.
And what did you say?
I didn't say anything. Rose exhales.
Of all the things Mum could talk about with her newfound speech, she really does have a gift for ruining our lives.
Rose bends over and picks up the bracelet. I hesitate. Rose?
Hmm?
Was she really a bad Mum? Rose looks at me.
You know she was.
When I don't respond, she looks aghast.
Fern, she neglected us terribly. She dragged awful boyfriends in and out of our lives. For God's sake, she overdosed on pills, leaving us without even one parent who could care for us.
You're right.
Hallelujah.
But nothing, Rose groans. I get the sense that she's sorry for what she did. I think she loves us, Rose. Rose throws up her hands.
Agree to disagree, then. I know that you want to have a relationship with her, Fern, but trust me, she's not a good person. There are things you don't understand.
Rose waits for a response from me, so after a few seconds, I nod. After all, there must be things I don't understand.
because as I look back over my memories of Mum, at least 90% of them are good.
Journal of Rose Ingrid Castle. Fern didn't talk to me the day after she saw Billy and me kissing. She made basic conversation. Pass the tomato sauce. No thanks, I don't want to go to the river. But things were frosty enough that even Mum and Daniel noticed something was up.
What's going on with you kids? Daniel asked over lunch.
Nothing, the three of us said in unison.
Are you sure? Mum asked.
Yep. That was our line and we were sticking to it, at least where Mum was concerned. But even in private, Fern wasn't talking. It was strange. I was starting to get the feeling that I was right when I suspected Fern liked Billy, and now she was mad at us.
Come on, kids, snap out of it, Daniel said finally. It's your last night. Go swim. Go on. Off with you.
We tried to protest, saying we were tired, but Mum and Daniel were adamant. I think they wanted some privacy. We walked to the river in single file. Billy got straight into the water, keen to get away from the obvious tension. I sat on the riverbank beside Fern and waited. One thing I knew about Fern was that she wouldn't talk until she was ready. After an hour had passed and she still hadn't talked, I felt nature call. Billy was showing no signs of getting out of the water, splashing and swimming and swinging from the rope. So I headed deep into the trees. After everything that had happened, I didn't want Billy seeing me pee. It was slow going. It was dark, and I was barefoot. I had to watch every step I took. When I returned to the river, Fern was gone.
Fern, I called. Fern, where are you?
It was strange for her not to be in the spot I left her. It might have been that, combined with the fact that I was a worrier, that put me instantly on guard.
Fern?
Here, came a small voice. And then I saw her, illuminated by a patch of moonlight in the shallows of the river. She was standing eerily still.
What are you doing?
I asked. There was something about her facial expression. It gave me a bad feeling even before I saw what she